It's always good to see those with whom I've worked in the past and have known and come to appreciate. Harold and I go back at least 100 years. Agatha Christie made the comment that one of the good things about being married to an archaeologist is that the older you get, the more he appreciates you. Maybe that's the case. We're going to talk about Noah's Ark today, which has been one of the favorite objects of ridicule of unbelievers. Though they've not been doing that good a job with regard to faith in the existence of Noah's Ark on Ararat, according to some polls that have been made recently. I was rather surprised by the AOL poll taken in 2004, asking the question, do you believe that Noah's Ark exists? What percentage of our nation do you think would say, yes, I do? 78% said yes. Wow. Maybe we're doing some good, after all. AOL wasn't very happy with that. Obviously, since they published responses to the poll and every one of them was negative. One of them said, for example, when they're done in Turkey, they can go find Excalibur, Santa Claus, and catch some pixies. The objectors, the unbelievers, are shrill and loud. The flood story is not literal, it's a myth. To deny that fact is to deny the purpose and value of the Bible. And wouldn't that make them heretics? Wow. I'm not generally judgmental about people's beliefs, and I don't believe a word of that. But those who believe this literally have closed their eyes and brains completely. Desperately looking for any shred of evidence that will provide an old folks tale that's retarded. Well, that's typical of what you hear on college campuses. They're in the minority, fortunately, but we hear a lot of it. Retarded if you believe the story of Noah and the ark. Well, that has some obvious implications regarding Jesus Christ, because he did. Matthew 24, he says, for the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. They ridiculed Noah as they ridicule today, and so we ought not to be surprised. Likewise, Peter says, they deliberately suppress this fact, quoting here from the New English Translation. The world existing at that time was destroyed when it was deluged with water. The word translated deluge doesn't just mean a flood or a lot of water. It means catastrophe. We get our word catastrophe from that Greek term. Certainly, Jesus and his apostles believed the story. I don't think they were retarded. And if you claim to be a Christian, that's just an inconsistent position. We can show from the number of approaches that the flood was real, but we have to work on another problem. A lot of people say, oh yes, I believe the flood is real, but it was local. In fact, even National Geographic got in on the act recently. They've got a couple of fellows who said, oh, we proved Noah's flood. The Black Sea overflowed and flooded the Mesopotamian Valley. And that was the flood you read about in the Bible. Well, that's not the Bible description of the flood. Let's look at some evidences briefly for the fact that it was global. One of the obvious evidences is the abundant flood traditions that we see from virtually every society around the world. There are 59 separate flood traditions in North America, including the Eskimos, many of the different Indian tribes. 46 have been documented from Central and South America, 31 from Europe, 17 from the Middle East, 23 from Asia, even the Pacific Islands and Australia have the Aborigines with their flood traditions. I purchased a boomerang in the outback from one of the artisans there, and it had carvings on it. I asked what this was about. Well, this is the story of the flood. They had a different name for the patriarch, but there were eight people and the boat, and this was when the world was destroyed. And sometimes people will say, well, everybody knows about floods, and some of them were big, and they imagine it. Well, this was the outback in Australia. I don't think they've had a whole lot of floods out there. But that wouldn't account for seeing this all over the world, over 200 separate accounts. I think there's one good explanation for that. They have an actual event in the background of their history. Genesis tells us, in no uncertain terms, that this was universal. There's some 30 universal terms used in the flood chapters. For example, in Genesis 7, verse 19, the water prevailed more and more upon the earth, and some of the mountains were covered. Or as one of the liberal interpreters said, well, yeah, it rained and the tops of the mountains got wet. Well, they're trying, but that's not what it says. Everywhere under the heavens were covered. Verse 23, he blotted out everything that was upon the face of the land. And notice that the qualifying factor, this is not including those that live in the ocean. You don't need to have fish on the ark, do you? But those who are on the land were killed. Man to animals to creeping things to birds of the sky, they were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left together with those that were with him in the ark. But of course, these were just a few. Not too long after the creation, it takes millions of years for great populations to develop, and they were all in the Mesopotamian Valley. How many people were there on the earth at the time of the flood? 2,500 years if you follow the Septuagint, or about 1,600 if you follow the Masoretic, but not hundreds of thousands of years for the age of man that we see told us by the evolutionists. I think the study of population dynamics is one of the most obvious demonstrations that the old earth story doesn't hold water. If you take two people from the creation to the flood using the Septuagint rendition, taking present population growth rates, how many people would there be? Well, it's not a simple calculation. This is involving some pre-calculus, but we won't scare everybody off and bore you with that. You do know, have to know the rate, and the present rate in the U.S. is just over 1% growth rate. Now, that's pretty slow. Some of the third world countries are over 4%. But let's take, well, no, not 1%. Let's back it up to 0.88. Now, that's about as low as you can get and still exist. Obviously, I'm fudging. I'm playing with the numbers here to get it to come out the way I want it. At 0.88% growth rate, 8 billion people. That's what we got today, isn't it? Genesis chapter 6, verse 11 says, the earth was corrupt in the sight of the Lord, and the earth was filled with violence. So it wasn't just in the Mesopotamian Valley that we're talking about. And the fact that it wasn't a local flood, I think, should be obvious from Genesis 9, where God promised, I'll set my bow in the cloud. It shall be a sign of a covenant between me and the earth. I'll remember my covenant. Never again shall water become a flood to destroy the earth. And of course, there never have been any local floods since then, have there? Or have there? And if he was talking about a local flood, of course, that would make God a liar. What happened then was unique and has never happened again. Evidence from it is seen around the world, and that could easily take an hour's lecture to present just the geological evidence. But I think one of the most obvious involves the fact that you find seashells on tops of all the mountains. Now, I know what the geologists say about that, but that's a joke when you look at the realities. We spent a good bit of time in Israel of late here on top of Mount Nebo, from which Moses surveyed the promised land. We see all kinds of seashells right up on top of Mount Nebo. The highest mountain in the world, Mount Everest, that's the last place you'd expect to find seashells. But that's exactly what you find on the top of Mount Ararat. Here from Cambridge Press, you find the description of highest fossils in the world. I think that's a pretty safe statement. On top of Mount Everest. And when you compare that with the geologic column, it's really ironic to notice that the kinds of fossils that you do find on top of Mount Everest are Cambrian fossils, which are supposed to be the lowest layer in the geologic column. Wow, I couldn't have written that any better myself. But that's what's on top of the mountain. Mount Ararat, where I have climbed seven times for the last 7 years, and summited three times, you do find seashells well over a mile up. These were collected in 2013 at 7,800 feet. By myself. I think one of the strongest arguments for the fact that Mount Ararat was covered with water involves Pillar lava, which everybody understands, right? You know, probably need to be a geologist to understand that, but even Wikipedia does understand it. Notice the description. Pillar lavas are lavas that contain characteristic pillar-shaped structures. Look like big pillows. That are attributed to the extrusion of lava underwater. It goes on to say, pillar lavas are generally to confirm subaqueous volcanism. This forms when you're underwater. I'm sitting here on pillar lava at about 8,000 feet, and it's a whole field that extends for a great vast distance. This is one of my favorite pictures. It's not soft. And we notice the cross-section of one of them that shows the concentric circles. And I just challenge you to find a picture of pillar lava in the textbooks that is any more obvious. They need my picture as an illustration. This was at 8,000 feet and then higher still, now at about 12,000 feet, which is over 2 miles up. You see pillar lava, which is indication of subaqueous volcanism deposited underwater, extruded. Another, and we're just running quickly through this, which, as we suggested, can often take much longer if we go into detail, but the fact that you find layers that are continuous, laid down by water, sedimentary rock, that extend globally. For example, the Austin Chalk, which is a very unique layer, described here by Derek Ager, former president of the British Geological Association. Some general explanation is surely needed. He doesn't have one. He's an unbeliever. For such a wide distribution of such a unique facies or community here that compose this layer, it extends essentially in the same form all the way from Texas to the USSR. The similarities are almost laughable. And it's hard to explain that by a local flood. But this requires a global explanation, and he'd like to have one. We need it, but he doesn't have it. I've collected samples here from Israel, from Austin, Texas, where it got its name. It's called sometimes other things in other places, but it's exactly the same stuff with very unique fossils underlaid by glauconic sands, very easy to identify. from England, from Israel, from Jordan, and from Egypt. There's good reason to believe that this was a global flood, from what the Bible says, from the flood traditions, from the pillar lava, from the seashells on the mountaintops around the world, and from the global layers. You've got about 10 minutes worth of a 1 hour lecture there. But the objection that we get involves, how in the world do you get all of those animals on that little bitty ark? That's just not possible. Well, how many animals were there? Well, I don't know, but you couldn't get them on the ark. Well, how big was the ark? I don't know, but you couldn't get all those animals on it. And some of them do put the pencil to it, and they don't always figure objectively. Ernst Mayr said, look, there's at least a million that you'd have to have two by two on the ark. Well, what's wrong with this estimate? You've got fishes and things that live in the ocean. 70% of the earth's surface is covered by oceans, and those are things you don't have to have on the ark, do you? Basically, you've got mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians, and not all of them. Some mammals live in the ocean, and likewise some reptiles. And we're looking at species in his calculation, which is not the equivalent of the biblical kind. Study of the use of the term shows it's considerably broader. But the total species are much narrower, therefore a larger number, would be about 17,000. You'd have to multiply that times two of each, which gets you to about 35,000. Then you've got clean animals, seven each of those, and so maybe you've got 35,000 plus 1,000. You also have those animals that have become extinct. And let's just say we've got had twice as many in the past. Half of them have become extinct, to be very generous. 5,000 clean animals, which is way more than would have been required. Using the outside maximum of all the parameters, you've got about 75,000 that you can come up with when you stretch everything. When you have a more reasonable estimate of kinds, you're looking at 5,000, and some of our creation scientists have concluded it's about half of that number. But let's say 5,000 times 2 would be 10, and then you double the number for extinction. We've got much less today, which, by the way, is not an upward process, is it? That's a degenerative process. And then 1,000 clean animals would be a more reasonable estimate. So we're looking at somewhere between 20 to 75,000 animals. Do you have that much room on the ark? Well, not if you're looking at the little Fisher-Price toys that most people think of when they think about the ark, with the giraffe sticking his head way out always, for some reason. It looked more like this, which is a different picture, isn't it? And yes, we have dinosaurs going up the gangplank. There was plenty of room. Wouldn't have had to have had the largest. Seismosaurus, I think, was the great-great-grandpa. Reptiles never stop growing all of their life, unlike mammals. And I think they lived longer before the flood and got really, really, really big. Maybe the juvenile forms looked more like this and certainly would have had plenty of room for that on the ark. It's interesting to note the picture described in World Book of dragons that are strangely like actual creatures that have lived in the past compared with dinosaurs. Dinosaurs were generally evil and destructive, and every country had them. And of course, we see them all the way through the Bible, including Leviathan and Behemoth. More recently, Dracorex, the word for dragon, was a name given a recent discovery of a dinosaur, and the head looked very dragon-like. And so that's the name. I think that's what they were. But then that's another story. Let's move to the ark's capacity. You have to know how big the ark is to know if this is reasonable and if we can get 75 to 20,000 animals on it. You'd have to know how long it was. I believe 21 feet is the length, 21 inches is the length of a cubit. We have good reason for that. It'd take a while to explain. For one reason, we've measured, but we'll leave that for later. That would give us a vessel 525 feet long. We're talking about two football fields in length, and about the height of a five-story building. Is that the way you've thought of the ark? That's different than the little Fisher-Price pictures, isn't it? And, of course, 2 million cubic feet really doesn't communicate a whole lot to a lot of people. How much space is that? Well, if we compare it to railroad cars, we're talking about 750 railroad cars, and you've never seen a train that long. It never has been one that long, far beyond the world's record. How many animals can you fit in there? Well, you can fit about 240 sheep per railroad car, and that's the standard that's used for shipping them across the country. What's the average size animal? Well, we think of horses and cows first. They're the biggest. The average is more the size of a cat. There are many more shrews and mice and smaller animals than there are larger animals. But you don't ship cats across the country in railroad cars that often. We do ship sheep, and so we've got a pretty good handle on how many you can put in a railroad car. And so you multiply 750 railroad cars times the 240 sheep, you've got 180,000 animals to show you the capacity of this size ark. Now, when we assume that kind equals species, which is not a realistic assumption, we use the splitter's estimate of the number of species, the people that multiply more than I think are justified, the double the number for extinction, and double the average size, then we've got 75,000 as an outside maximum, but we've got room for 180,000. So you see, this is not a valid objection. You can handle all of them based on how you ship sheep across the country in 42% of the ark's capacity. If you use more reasonable estimates for the numbers, you're talking about 12%. 12% of the ark's capacity. Well, that means you can spread them out more, doesn't it? Now, that'd be a good idea. Maybe you could have all of them on the bottom floor, have the food on the second floor. You just drop the food down to them and have the third floor on top for all Mr. and Ms. No One family. In fact, you could have a regulation-sized football field up on the top floor and still have room for all the animals to come up to watch. Now, where's the problem? It's the atheist whose ideas need to be ridiculed. They haven't done the figuring, or if they have, they've not done it fairly. If you want answers to objections, and there are plenty of inventive, imaginative objections that come up, I can assure you that you will find them in this book, A Feasibility Study by John Woodmerappy, who has researched all the objections made over the past 100 years by atheists and has cataloged them and given answers to them. It's a whole lot more information than you'd want to know. But let's move to another question. It is feasible. This story that we read in the ark works, but could it still be there? That's a different question, but an interesting question. There are a lot of people who say they found it. Here's a newspaper article about finding it on Mars, and another one found it under Saddam's palace in Iraq. And you've got all kind of con men claiming that they have found it and made a good bit of money over it, and we won't go into detail. One of the objections that some people raise is, well, can wood last 4,500 years? If you go to some of the museums, it's obviously not that much of a problem. If you look at the pharaonic sunboat, interestingly, found near Cheops that was buried, discovered not too long ago, supposed to be 4,500 years old. I don't think it's quite that old, but maybe close. It's held together with ropes, and it's in perfect shape. The ropes are in good shape. And then in Nature, reported not too long ago, here's noodles from China that are 4,000 years old. What's the problem with... We're not sure what gopher wood was, but obviously some kind of resistant to decay wood covered with pitch, like creosote. That's better than noodles. It's more resistant to decay. Very interesting find reported just recently. A shoe with leather, perfectly preserved, supposed to be 5,500 years old. That's over 1,000 years older, according to, I don't think it's that old, but close to the 4,500 years, and even the shoelaces are preserved, and interestingly, it's about 50 miles from Mount Ararat. Maybe we've found Noah's shoe here. What's the problem? You know, that's not a problem. One thing that is a problem is the political circumstance that surrounds Mount Ararat. It's in eastern Turkey, right up against Armenia and Iran, not too far from Iraq or Syria or Lebanon. You know any problems that might exist in that part of the world? It's in eastern Turkey where the Kurds have been at war with the Turks for the past 30 years. They've killed over 40,000 people over that dispute. They think this is Kurdistan. Turkey disagrees, and they've been fighting about it and killing each other. I'm standing here with my back to the border of Iran and looking forward at the border crossing. I'm on the Iran side looking back at Mount Ararat. You can see the proximity. And then to the north from Armenia, former Soviet Union, you see Mount Ararat from the middle of the city. It's in a difficult area. We've been in the middle of some of the battles, unfortunately. Well, what's the evidence that it might be there? As you go back in time, looking at various histories, the ancient histories speak of it as, matter of fact, people were seeing it on a regular basis. You notice, for example, Josephus says all the writers of barbarian histories make mention of the flood of the ark. All of them. Now, anybody that's not a Jew is a barbarian, but all of them, and he mentions six in particular that spoke to witnesses that had seen it. Some of them had been there. This land also possesses the remains of the ark, he says, the remains which to this day are seen, shown to those who are curious to see them. But it seems that these sightings that were ubiquitous in New Testament times just declined and within 1,000 years disappeared, and you hear nothing more until about 1840, when there was a huge earthquake that opened up a big gash in the side of the mountain and shook off a lot of the ice and I think revealed it. From then, we've had about 25 very credible sightings. One of the most obvious, and I think there are four that are dependable and those that we can verify. One involves Georgi Hagopian, who was there in 1904. He was one of the Armenians that lived at the base of the mountain. This was their mountain, and they were devout believers in Christ. About 3 million of them were massacred. Big controversy over who did that, but monuments on opposite sides of that historical issue within miles of each other in that area. Georgi escaped to America along with a very few others. But he had been up the mountain with his uncle twice and had seen it and told the story to several. And this is the picture that was drawn from his eyewitness account. Not anything like the old master paintings. It's more like a barge designed to carry something. I'd always wondered about the one window in the ark and if it extends the whole length like a baffle, then yeah, that makes sense. The King James says it was finished a cubit and a half upward. What does that mean? Well, maybe there it is. This was another view. We have found at least four that tell a story that we can learn a lot about. Artumov was a Russian general who was dispatched by the Tsar to go up the mountain after some Russian aviators had seen it. They, with 50 others, saw this photograph, measured. While they were up on the mountain, about 2 months, the Bolshevik Revolution took place. The Tsar was murdered, and most of the clerics in that part of Armenia, Russia. And when they came down, they had pictures. Most of them were killed, he says. There were at least three that we know of that escaped. He came to Oklahoma City. And this is a sketch of the picture that he had with him that his nephew drew for us. He has the original, he says, in his attic, and he's promised to show us, but he's a very promising young man. That hasn't happened. He's been threatened, and there is a family of Kurds that live on the mountain that had as their purpose in life to protect the ark from the eyes of the infidel. This is where Muhammad is supposed to return when he comes back if they keep it pure, and so they kill people that get too close. We have solved that problem, I believe. We've made peace with them, and they are cooperating at this point. But these are four different pictures. The one in the lower right-hand corner is a portion of the picture that was seen by Ed Davis, who was there in 1943 as a part of the Army Corps of Engineers. He saved the life of one of the Kurdish village chieftains' grandsons, and then as a reward, showed gratitude, which is part of their religion. They carried him up at the end of the summer and showed him the ark. He got within somewhere between 50 and 100 yards. Couldn't get closer because of the storm, but viewed it with his army field glasses from that distance, and then drew the picture of what he saw here with a commercial artist, a friend of mine. Very detailed picture, and I think we have located this valley called the Ed Davis Valley now, painted more recently to look like this. A vivid picture of what he says that he saw. He has taken three polygraph tests and passed all of them with flying colors. But by the time he saw it, it had broken into two pieces. Glaciers move, and that is not surprising. In the years that have passed, that valley has filled up with ice. But that was witnessed in 1943. Well, can ice build up that fast? We compare that to some of the World War II airplanes that were abandoned in Greenland, that were abandoned in 1943, the same year, and since then 260 feet of ice built up, and we've drilled down, or they have, and actually pulled one of them out and flew it back to Texas. It was in Victoria for a while. It's now back up in Kentucky. We're told that it takes a year to form one of these layers. There are literally hundreds of thousands of layers that all happen in 50 years, which is very interesting. The valley that we see, the Ed Davis Valley, is about 90 feet from top to bottom. That's not 260, but about 90. And this piece is about 40 feet under the surface, maybe as little as 30 in some places. And that's been our target. The head of our project is Dr. Dick White. He's traveled up the mountain 36 times, has traveled with Irwin, the astronaut, and climbed with a number of individuals, obviously. We have Dr. Randall Price, who is has his Ph.D. from Middle Eastern Studies, University of Texas, who works with us. Dr. John Bryant. His Ph.D. is from A&M in geophysics. He's licensed as an engineer, as a geologist, as a geophysicist, and as a cartographer. And he runs marathons, and he's a pretty good fellow to have on the team. We have alpinist Kevin DeVry, who's climbed Everest and been to the North Pole. And He says it's his job to keep the PhDs alive. So far, he's been successful. We also have an individual with the government that we can't describe too much in detail. He's access to classified material, though he's very careful about how that's handled. But we have satellite telemetry that can see under the ice with the microwave technology. And it sees this picture. And he's drawn this sketch from what he sees. Can't let us see what's on his monitor. But this is the sketch that he has drawn and the two pieces that correspond to Ed Davis's sighting. And so we want to climb up the mountain and dig down through the ice and see if we can find that. Now that's much easier said than done. This is a picture of the mountain, and this is the site, and it's 3.5 miles from top to bottom. The first day's trek looks like this. It goes up to that little white speck that you may be able to see, which is a pretty good size tent. That's at 10,500. That's a long ways up there, but it's not getting started very good on this mountain. This is an area where a lot of fighting goes on. And in the vicinity, the rebel Kurds have used this mountain as their hideout for at least 25 years. And we've seen the results of that fighting, and we can hear the gunshots in the distance often. From there, there is a much more difficult climb up to the next base camp. And you can see the little white tents there. That's at 14,000 feet, and that's about as high as it gets in the contiguous U.S. Pikes Peak is 14.4. This is a picture of the very comfortable scene that you see when you get there. One of the Kurds who is helping us is thanking Allah for his trip with the rainbow in the background. It's not comforting to understand that all of those rocks have come down from above, and you can hear them tumbling down through the night. From that site, you look down and you can't see down. It's under the clouds. And then you look up and that's the way to the top. And those rocks tumble and roll when you step on them. One of them did under my feet like a log in the water, and I took a tumble and big gash in my head. Had to go down and get sewed up. In a Turkish hospital that had more flies than people. But I got a very professional head bandage as a result, and then got to climb back up again to the base camp. And then from there is a murderous trek up to 17,000 feet. We have to go over that and then another about a mile and a half on the other side. As you get up on the glacier, there are new dangers. Crevasse from all directions. Sometimes you can see them, and sometimes you can't. There was a diagram on the right shows one that's virtually invisible as you approach, but if you fall through, that's the end of it, unless you're roped together. Here you can see the large crevasse in the foreground and the background. In the foreground, you see one that was invisible till Kevin stepped in it and was leading with the rope and dangled right on down through that hole. He had the presence of mind and was kind of enjoying himself hanging on the rope to take a picture while he was down there looking back up. I'm glad that was him, but we pulled him out. Other dangers are illustrated here is Tom Russell, who preached with me in Dallas. He's preaching there, and I got stranded on this plain, which is about 600 feet below the summit, for about 12 hours in a whiteout. We couldn't move. The cliff just in the distance there is about 3 miles straight down. You don't want to wander around when you can't see where you're going. We were stranded there without a parka or a tent or a sleeping bag, in sub-zero temperatures in 80 to 90 mile an hour winds, a huge storm. And that's a very lethal situation. Some of the Kurds saw the storm coming. They were carrying our duffel bags with our sleeping bag and tent and parkas. And they dropped some of the bags and headed on for camp about an hour away and made it. About 11 o'clock that night, we saw some of the bags in the distance as there was a break in the clouds and thought they were rocks and went over to get some relief from the wind. Found a few of the duffel bags, stacked them up as a shield. One of them had hand warmers and foot warmers in it, which we stuffed in our shirts and pants and undoubtedly saved our lives and survived till the next morning. This is not a fun journey. Lots of dangers. And as you approach the top, you realize there's no air up here. It's about 60 feet and huff and puff. Amazingly, you recover pretty quickly and you go another 60 feet and huff and puff. And that's the way you get up to the top. That's not the objective. That's kind of neat to get there. But we go over the top. And about a mile and a half to the Ed Davis Valley, which has now been filled up. And this is the spot for our target where we were digging. The first night up there, we had 80 mile an hour winds that almost covered the tents. This was Randall's tent the next morning. The next night, it got bad. The wind gauge broke at 100 miles an hour. And that's not good when you're in a tent on top of a mountain about 3 days from civilization. It shredded some of the tents. This was our director's tent the next morning. I pulled him out at about 3 o'clock in the morning. He was unconscious or semi-conscious, in the third stage of hypothermia, and drug him into my tent and stuffed him in a sleeping bag. Somebody said I should have gotten in there with him, but I was going to see if he's going to make it the next morning, and he did. We also have to carry some very technical equipment up, and this was John Bryant's equipment he's in charge of. We were able to determine that one of the pieces that we were concentrating on had broken again with the movement of the glacier. This was a view that we got with a Turkish satellite. It goes. We have one satellite that goes across so that we get a number of different angles. Another that's geosynchronous stays in place. And they give slightly different readings, which is one of the problems. But with the equipment that he has, and you notice the stereo radar set that he has there, we drag that across the ice in a grid to determine what's under the ice. And that's not easy when there's no air up there. And also using electrical resistivity equipment. And John Bryant then broadcast that back to his office in Dallas, and they crunch the numbers and give us back the information. It's been very frustrating trying to find what the satellite sees. It gives us the coordinates, but what we're finding is the coordinates shift from morning to evening. Possibly as a result of the war effort, they found how to scramble the GPS readings. And here's a hole that we dig in the evening. We take the coordinates. We go 1 meter to the south the next morning, but it's 100 meters to the south according to the GPS. Wait a minute. And so finding what the satellite says has been a major challenge. This is some of the readings that he got from the grid. And one of the years we were able to determine that our hole missed very slightly what was determined to be wood. This is the equipment, the tent, dig tent over the hole. We dug an 8x8 hole in the ice with the aluminum framework that we hauled up the mountain that I helped design. And beginning with chainsaws, you cut it into blocks and then lift it out. We had drilled and the drill had stuck. We thought we had hit it. We hadn't, but we thought so. And so we dug. I don't have to tell you, that's a lot of work. That's an amazing amount. And notice the ice is pure. This is like an ice cube. The glaciers on the side of the mountain move like tractor treads. They pick up rocks. They're full of rocks. This is not moving. This is in a bowl in the Ed Davis Basin that has preserved it. And again, you can see that in the background of this picture. Here, the dig tent is seen with the blocks of ice that have been hauled out of that hole. I'm the second from the right in that picture, and here pictured with the glacier glasses, but the big chunks of ice are seen out here to the right. And maybe this will give you a picture of the kind of effort that's going on where they're working in extreme cold and without air. Less than 50% of the oxygen normally has. The snow level and the rocks on top of the ice. There's no rocks below that. We got down to the bottom, which was where we were supposed to have found it according to the satellite. We had live feedback from the fellow with the satellite saying, "You're right on top of it." And we said, "No, we're not." And he said, "Yes, you are." And we said, "No, we're not." And we got down there and it wasn't there. And you have a hard time imagining how much disappointment and frustration there was after that kind of work to find that we had missed it. According to the satellite from the Turkish information, we were about 8 feet away from it. At that point, the movie crew that was with us, and by the way, the Finding Noah movie will be coming out later this year, they were with us as we were doing the dig. They left, but we, with information from the Turkish satellite, decided to do some drilling with these augers a little more than 8 feet in the direction where they said we should. And it produced some debris that appeared to be wood. And so I took some of those pieces back down to the hospital in Dogabasit at the foot of the mountain and put it under the microscope. And what do you think we saw? You understand what you're looking at. I don't think we hit the main body of the ark, but part of the debris field. We then began to dig in different places, and that is with the auger. The season was over at this point, and it was time to go, but they continued to work. And their efforts produced a jar full of debris. And you can see some of it covered with black pitch and pieces of wood, enough to assure us that we're not far away. Further evidence from the radar indicates that's probably a debris field, which the satellite had seen as well. The circumstance that we're encountering is much like a mirage. What you're seeing is real, but it's not where you're seeing it. The GPS has been skewed, and so that's a challenge. Very frustrating challenge. What do you do? Well, we were folding our tents and getting ready to go when we got a command to appear before the rebel Kurds, who have their hideout up on the mountain. They had been watching us for the past 7 years, and they wanted to talk with me. And so we met with them up on the mountain, and they said, "We know there is debris under the ice, and there are large pieces of the ark there, but we know where there's another piece that's exposed, about 100 feet long. Wouldn't it be easier just to go to one that's not under the ice that's exposed?" I said, "Well, yeah, I think so." They said, "Well, we've been trying to decide whether to show you this, because we've been using it as a hideout for the past 25 years. I said, well, you need to understand. I understand your belief that this is Kurdistan, that this is your mountain, that this is your ark. But I said, sir, this story is not yours. God intended that story for the whole world. It's a picture of God and His reality and the reality of His revelation, and the fact that God will judge is made obvious. The seriousness of sin and His mercy. And I said, the world needs that picture, and you're keeping it from them. And you could see the tears in his eyes. This is the general, the head of the military command for the rebel Kurds. He said, you're right. He said, I agree with you. But he said, we have to clear this with the political head, which is down in northern Iraq, where the battle is raging. I said, well, can't you ask him? He said, no, you have to go there. That they're high on protocol. And so we take off to northern Iraq. Here's one of our Kurdish contacts who's with us. We cross the border. We're in the middle of a battle. 46 people were killed within earshot that day when we were there. But in the military, in the political headquarters there, in the inner portion, they did have a picture of what is basically their military headquarters on one of the monitors. They wouldn't let us take a picture of the monitor or give us a copy, but we drew a sketch. And that's what we saw. You see the soldiers in the foreground, to give you perspective of the size. It's about 80 feet across. It's about 60 feet tall. And about a 100-foot section that goes back up against the glacier. It's black. You can't see planking. It's covered, evidently, with pitch. And they said yes. Now, that's a very short version of the story. We weren't able to go that year, but we had the appointment to go this past summer. We were blocked. We got to Istanbul, and we were found to be on the no-fly list. Some of the con men had bribed some in the Department of Interior, and we were not allowed in. We got pressure with some ambassadors, some congressmen, congresswomen. Michelle Bachmann was a big help. And we have finally gotten that cleared, but now then it's winter again. But we are meeting with them again this week, and we'll know before this week is out the program for this coming spring, when we will be there to document this. And we'll appreciate your prayers. Think about the implications before we conclude this morning. If we document a vessel like this 2 miles, 3 miles high, how did it get there? A local flood, you can't have a local flood 3 miles high. That doesn't work, does it? That's absurd. It says that there was a supernatural judgment. And I don't think there's any alternative view. We'll be talking later this week about the sedimentary rock that covers the continents to an average depth of a mile to a half mile. Rock laid down by water with billions of dead things in it. How do you account for that? The evolutionist says it's slow and gradual over millions of years. We say, no, it's a flood deposit. It's rapid, catastrophic. If we get the vessel 3 miles up, I think we win the argument. And theirs is wrong. Gilbert Grosvenor was the first editor of National Geographic, and he understood the implications. He says the discovery of Noah's Ark would be the greatest archaeological find in human history, the greatest event since the resurrection of Christ, and would alter all the currents of scientific thought. I don't think that's an overstatement. Tom Jarrell is an unbeliever for ABC. He says, consider if the biblical story of creation is fact and not fable, then the theory of evolution is all wet. A confirmed discovery, he's talking about Noah's Ark, would be the greatest archaeological find of all times and provide religious fundamentalists hard evidence of the Bible's absolute reliability. I think he gets it, even the unbeliever. We recall that Jesus said, they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away when it was too late. So will the coming of the Son of Man be. This is a prefiguring of what's in our future. The world was destroyed by water. God will judge. Sin is serious. It's not a joke. As Peter says, the day of the Lord will come, talking about what that demonstrates to us. He will judge. This time, the heavens will pass away with a roar, destroyed with intense heat. The earth and its works will be burned up. First by water, then by fire. There is a great day coming, and you need to be ready. It's a picture of God's judgment. It's also a picture of His mercy. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 7, by faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not seen, in reverence prepared an ark for the salvation of his household. Peter refers to the long-suffering of God while the ark was preparing, wherein few, that is, eight souls were saved. Corresponding to that, baptism now saves you. If you're here this morning and haven't rendered obedience to the gospel, confessed your faith, and been baptized into Christ after having confessed, following the instructions that we find in that dependable record, then you need to do so this morning. God's mercy won't last forever, but His judgment is real. Won't you come while we stand together and sing?